Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucktopians? What the fucktuckians? What the fuck is happening? What is happening? I'm Mark Maron, and this is WTF, my podcast. Welcome to it. How's your Monday? Are you okay? I'm recording this a couple days early for a couple various reasons, but I'm happy to be here. We have a great show today. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is here a little later in the show to talk about everything but basketball. Dr. Phil Stutz, I'm going to talk to him a little bit. He's got a new book out. He was on episode 454 back in 2013 after Hank Azaria recommended him, actually. And, you know, people told us how helpful that episode was for them. His new book is called Coming Alive. He wrote it with Barry Michaels again, comes out August 22nd. He'll be here in just a little while. What are we going to do? What are we going to do, America? Are we going to keep it together? There is a need for relief in a relentlessly depressing and frightening cultural environment and political environment. I mean, whatever, what happened over the weekend in Charlottesville is disconcerting. Just the you saw a lot of representatives of the army of unfuckable hate nerds and militia types in varying degrees of armor and outfits. Some oddly more ridiculous than I think they intended. And there's some just flat out old school racists out there. And the counter protests were powerful and courageous and trying to hold the line, maintain the balance, make people understand. There are people out there fighting this racism and intolerance and violence. And I think that the difficult thing for most people, now you granted that, again, this is a minority of people, is that, you know, we have a leader, a president that refuses to really put his foot down in a definitive way when it comes to this type of behavior, whether it be blowing up mosques or a KKK Nazi rally. I don't think he's mentioned anything about the American terrorist attack on the mosques. But, you know, let's just make clear that, you know, Nazis and the Klan are not good. That'd be nice to hear from the president, but he will not do it in those definitive terms, unlike many members of Congress, many senators, past presidents, because the bottom line is he doesn't want to come right out and say that Nazis are bad because he doesn't want to alienate his base. That's where we're at as a country. The president does not want to condemn Nazis or the KKK because he just doesn't want to alienate his base. It's a scary business, and there's a lot of things that are untethered and chaotic and, you know, frightening about leadership at this point in time. And sadly, but also in a good way, you will be called upon as an American to stand up for this at some point. It's easy to, here I am in California, and there's part of me that's sort of like, well, it's not down the street from me. It's not in this state. It doesn't directly involve me, but it directly involves all of us. We are Americans, and it really is going to come down to what America do you want to live in, and what can you rationalize? The rationalizing question is a big question because, you know, most people in America are like, well, you know, look, I'm okay. It doesn't affect me that much. Believe me. I'll do a little Trumpism there. Believe me. All of this affects all of us. We are all Americans. We have different ideas. We have different opinions. And we have different beliefs about democracy. And those will and are being called into question and are worth fighting for. So it's on all of us to do something. You know, you might have to do more than you're comfortable with. And I'm always grateful that people are out there fighting, you know, the counter-protesters and people in the government and people speaking out. We're going to have to do that. Continue doing it. There's no, you can't really put your blinders on. I can't. Even the amount that I do it now, even the small amount that I try to detach is causing me chest pains and headaches and queasiness. Dark times, scary times, but the fabric of America is still woven. It's not completely unraveled. And look, you know, I have no doubt that, you know, if it is happening and if it does happen, that Americans will sort of like slowly evolve into accepting authoritarianism because they feel like they have no choice. And, you know, the one benefit of that is that, look, when America will be the best authoritarian state on this planet, because when Americans put their minds to it, they can do anything. So America will certainly be just a barometer of excellence and authoritarianism if enough people don't think what is happening in this country now involves them or affects them. You don't want to get down the line where you're like, yeah, I mean, my life's not that much different. I mean, there weren't that many Mexicans here or before they were all, you know, told to leave, but it didn't really affect my life that much. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess, you know, a lot of black people are, you know, there's not a lot in my neighborhood, so I don't really know what's going on with them. Yeah, before the Muslims were all kicked out of the country, I didn't really know any, you know. So really, you know, it's just like I still just go, you know, I go get coffee and I go over to where I work. And I don't know, it's just not that much different. That's what the sound of an authoritarian America is. Yeah, I guess some people got hurt down there, but, you know, I don't know. It looked bad, but I think those people that were protesting were, you know, I mean, they seemed really out of line and angry. I mean, isn't there another way to handle it? I mean, it was terrible, but like, I don't know why they were causing trouble. I love this country. And, it's just sad that so many people are so angry. They should just relax. That's what authoritarian America sounds like. Or like, no, I don't really, you know, I don't vote and I don't really pay attention to the news. And like, you know, politics is so boring. It's so boring. That's what authoritarian America, that's how it happens. So, let me tell you, I had another weird dream. This one was really wild. All I remember is I was on like some sort of bungee cord, but it wasn't hanging from something. It was sort of throwing me back and forth. You know what I mean? Like it was anchored somewhere and I was bouncing from one, you know, one thing. I'd go up and then I'd go down and then I'd go over. And every time the rubber band or the bungee would go all the way to the end where I'd have that moment where you stop before you snap back. My surroundings would be in black and white and it would be sort of, you know, elements of my past. And then it'd go to another area where I'd just be bouncing into these sort of weird black and white vignettes of my past. And it just kept going like that. And for some reason, John Hamm was running the controls back in time bungee ride in black and white. That was a John Hamm operated carnival concession. What do you make of that, dream analysts? I got some pretty good analysis from my last one. I didn't read that. Maybe I'll read it on maybe on Thursday. So Dr. Phil Stutz, it's always nice to see him. His new book is called Coming Alive. He wrote it with Barry Michaels. It comes out August 22nd. It approaches self-help in a way that maybe will have a little more staying power. And we talk about, you know, those type of books in general and the effect that they do have. But he's a bright guy, and it's always good to talk to him. We generally have good conversations, and he makes me feel smart sometimes. Both times he's been here. So this is me talking to Phil Stutz. You usually wake up earlier or later?
I'm 70 years old, so I wake up at like 6, but I can't stay up.
Why do we wake up earlier as we get older? It seems like my theory is that we innately know we're running out of time.
That makes perfect sense. That's excellent. I think that's right.
You think that's right?
Oh, God.
Everybody, you know, from our last conversation, the longer one, that the Tools has helped a lot of people, the book, The Tools, and I hear a lot about it. Did you hear a lot about it?
It's funny. I hear more about it now than I did when the book came out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And it sort of picked up?
It picked up, yeah. You know why? The audience for this stuff, most of the time, they're not going to buy the book unless they're in trouble. So,
all right.
It's a life preserver. You know, time's on our side.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. People are eventually going to get into a problem.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, it's like healthcare. Eventually, it's going to hit you. And then, you know, there's a financial aspect. So if we can, you know, a book that you buy for $20 or whatever it is, if that can help you, that's fantastic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But people love the book. And then I get this new book from you two. Same guys, right? Phil Stutz, you. Barry Michaels, the other guy.
Yeah, the other guy.
That you write with. And we talked about him. But this is called Coming Alive, 4 Tools to Defeat Your Inner Enemy, Ignite Creative Expression, and Unleash Your Soul's Potential.
Yeah.
I think we're
overstating it?
I tell you, you got to sell the covers to cover. You know what I mean? If you can deliver on all that, then great.
Oh, wait, we have to deliver on it too?
No, yeah, you can't just put that on the cover and then that's it.
All right.
Look, I got problems.
Yeah, it's not obvious, but go ahead.
Maybe we can help apply some of this stuff. Because I know, like, these books for me, you know, I read them, you know, I get a little bit out of them, and then, like, I don't finish them, and then I feel like I read halfway through it, and I'm like, I got enough. I think you know what I mean? How much of this do I need? I get the idea, and I move on.
Yeah, and you have your own TV show now, right?
I do.
So what else could you possibly need?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, Doc, because, what I learned is that years ago I always thought, like, well, if money doesn't make you happy, I'd like to figure that. I'd like to find that out firsthand. And, you know, now that I earn a pretty good living,
yeah.
it's definitely changed some fears,
yeah.
You know, and some insecurities that it put those to rest. But the fundamental stuff, it doesn't change that much.
No, in fact, that's actually the premise of what we do. In other words, and we have some credibility because we treat all these people that are very successful,
yeah,
as stars or whatever. And there's what we call a realm of illusion, which is somebody tells himself, if I only get this, my own show, if I only get that,
yeah,
a certain female he wants to marry, whatever,
right,
it is, that then life will become easy.
Yeah.
And what obviously that never happens. Never.
No, never?
No.
In all your experience, no one ever came in and said, hey, you know what? I'm done. I got what I wanted. Thank you.
No one's ever said that. If they do, if it was true, I would try to talk them out of it. It's bad cash flow for us. So we don't really want it anyway.
Yeah.
No, but seriously, that's why a lot of guys will become famous, they'll blow up suddenly,
yeah,
and then they get into drugs and alcohol. Sometimes they even kill themselves. It's like, I did my share. I did what I was supposed to do, which is become famous, become,
yeah,
you know, very successful. And life still has the same problems. What the fuck, you know?
Right.
I'm being gypped.
Sometimes more problems.
Yeah, sometimes. Or certainly problems you didn't have before.
Yeah, like, you know, what to do with all that money and then how to manage all the shit you bought with it.
Yeah, that's really overwhelming.
So how is this different than the other book?
Well, okay, here's the difference. The other book, which basically was four very common, or the four most common problems people have, we addressed them kind of one by one. But what we didn't have in the first book is a cohesiveness.
Uh-huh.
So there was nothing that tied the thing together. And people would ask us, what, you know, why those tools? Is there more to this? And the main thing people would say is, I like the book, I like what you said in it, but my effort fizzled out.
Fizzled out.
Yeah.
Like they, you know, like they applied the tools, and then after a year, they just they couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, and a year would be a long time. A lot of times, you know, they'll do it for 3 months, 2 months. They get excited. You know, and I'm an enthusiast. My partner's an enthusiast.
Yeah.
So sometimes you get, Freud called this a flight into health. Did you ever hear of that?
Sure, I do it all the time. After this interview, I'm going to go work out. I'm in one of my flights into health right now.
Okay.
Is that what it is?
Well, a flight into health doesn't last. That's why he called it a flight into health. He made certain other mistakes we'll talk about later.
Freud did?
Yeah.
He's fallen a bit out of favor, but he did have some good ideas. He was a solid thinker.
Yes, he had some brilliant ideas, in fact, which connects to what we're talking about. See, it seems like, well, these tools work, but I stop using them, I'm lazy, whatever, which is there's some truth in that. But what I discovered when I started this is a counter force.
Mm-hmm.
And I call the counter force part X.
Yeah.
Now, I just call it part X because
the thing that stops you from following through.
Yes.
Or sticking with it.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So when I was a young shrink, I was, needless to say, I was somewhat rebellious and defiant.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I was also very enthusiastic. So I was starting up my practice. I was maybe 30 years old, and I was helping a lot of people. A lot of times their symptoms would go away temporarily.
Right.
But after 3 months, 6 months, whatever, it would all come crashing back on them. Not only would it come back, it was worse than when they started.
Yeah.
And there was another problem, which is they lost faith in the whole process.
Sure. Not only did it not work, but, clearly it's that thing's fault.
It's that, yes.
Yeah.
So it's your secret enemy working behind the scenes, so to speak.
Sure. Always. It's like they say in the recovery racket that when you're not drinking, your disease is doing push-ups.
I heard that one.
But I mean, there is the issue of self-sabotage and sort of like, you know, I mean, Mike, you know, I guess a broader question is that, you know, you talk to a lot of people. These are practical things that people can do with a context. But some of this stuff is pretty deeply wired, right?
Yes.
But you believe that, you know, through a certain amount of discipline, that maybe you can reroute neural pathways or change your behavior for good. But it's a battle. It's a struggle.
Yeah, it has to be a struggle. You know, lately what I read is not so much psychiatric books. I like to read books by ex-military guys and people that are training professional athletes at a high level. And their whole thing is, what do they call it? Brain retraining.
Yeah. Sure.
More or less.
Yeah.
And the one I'm most interested in was Stephen Curry. You know who he is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Curry is like a mediocre athlete who's the best player in the NBA.
Okay.
He's unbelievable. He's the best shooter ever in the history of basketball.
Mediocre athlete, though, is the key, right?
Yeah. I mean, for us, he would look like a god, obviously.
Right.
But in the NBA, he's mediocre. So I got into it. I said, how did this guy get so good? And I Googled it.
Yeah.
And there was a clip that came out of YouTube with his training program. And here's what he would do. There would be a big board, a big wooden board, and it would have like six or seven lights on the board, and each light corresponded to a specific move. Like a purple light would go on here, he'd fake to the right, cross over, and then another light would go on, he'd back up a few steps, take whatever, it doesn't matter what it was. But the change in colors from one of these lights to another was faster than you could think.
Right.
So to follow the lights, you had to give up complete thinking.
But you knew what was connected to the light. You knew the move that you had to do.
Yeah, well, at the beginning, you might not even know. You might even forget what the move was.
Right, but eventually it becomes habit.
It becomes habit.
Reflex.
Yes, and training a reflex faster than you can think is the secret of what we do. And if you do that religiously, it takes a long time. you can change these basic patterns.
I believe that's true, but I mean, you know, that what about all that time in between reflexive action? What about, like, oh, so you do the things, you get the pattern in place, but one day you're just going to be sitting there, you know, with a piece of cake going like, fuck, this is terrible.
Yeah, 100%.
What?
Depends on the cake, I guess.
What happens at that moment, though? I mean, that's the trickiest moment.
Okay, good. Excellent point. You should do this for a living. It was excellent.
I try.
Here's the thing. There are a million tiny moments throughout the day when this part X is attacking you and you don't even know it.
The bad guy inside.
Yeah, and the idea is the biggest changes in life, the strongest forces come in through the smallest things.
Yeah.
So we try, about John Wooden at all?
John Wooden, the coach?
Yeah, the coach. Yeah,
I kind of know him.
So anyway, he was a freak on that. There was like a certain way to tie your shoelaces.
Yeah.
Even a certain way to put your socks on. And it wasn't that any specific instructions he was giving them was so brilliant. It was the idea that there was a right way to do things, even the smallest things.
And also it's ritualizing.
Yes, it ritualizes it. So anyway, the tools are designed to go into the very small things.
Right.
They can also deal with the big things, but if you want to, go ahead.
I see what you're saying. So you know, in between, you know, when you're most vulnerable to factor X, is that what you called it?
I call it part X.
Part X, you know, coming at you from the inside, you know, you have a few things, little things you can do to either distract him or you.
Yes.
From ruining your life.
That's correct.
So now let's break it down here, because like I like systems. Now here's, maybe we can apply it to what I need to do. Does this help with media problems?
Yeah, I guess to the extent. I mean, I'm a walking example of it.
Yeah. Well, you have an illness that you find every day.
Yes, every day.
And you seem like you. I haven't seen you in a couple of years. You seem great.
Yeah, praise the Lord. I have Parkinson's, and it hasn't deteriorated at all.
Uh huh.
And shout out to Josh, to Jeff Bronstein, my neurologist.
Yeah?
Fantastic.
He's doing a good job?
Yeah, great job, yeah. It's an art to medicating somebody.
Oh, sure it is. Yeah, you know, unfortunately the canvas is you, and sometimes you got to repaint a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
You gotta try stuff out. But you on a good combination?
I'm on a good combination. My whole thing is energy. One of the things we deal with in here is people think they have a basic energy level and it can't be changed.
Mm.
So when they tire out, they feel, well, that's it. You know, go to sleep.
Right.
Watch TV.
Yeah.
You know, smoke a joint, whatever it is. But the conceit of that part of the book is you can increase your energy level. It's possible to increase it. When I was a baby shrink, you know, just learning, nobody ever mentioned energy as a factor in treating patients or how they ended up. But what I was seeing was the people with the highest energy, for the most part, were the most successful.
Yeah.
And for the most part, they were the ones with the highest energy were the hardest ones to stop, even
right,
if it was a failure, et cetera.
Right.
So it's, and because I don't have much energy because of the illness, I become very curious about it.
Now, what'd you learn about that? Well, I mean, I imagine when you were a baby shrink, no one was reading Wilhelm Reich. Orgone energy, come on, get in the box, fuel up. Do you remember that guy?
Yeah, how do you know about that?
What do you mean? I'm a broad-minded guy.
You know, there was a comic that was very into that.
Oh, yeah, back in the day?
Yeah, in New York. I can't remember the guy's name.
Well, it shows did you. He have a box?
He did, yeah. He had an orgone box.
Good for him.
Yeah, now, you know, if you get one, you just put your head in it now.
Yeah, that's all. You don't need to get all in.
I'm impressed that you knew about that.
Yeah, I'm sort of fascinated with that guy. So what did you learn about energy? Is that where you started? Is that when you were thinking about this book with energy?
Well, the book, we took four major things that we felt weakened the life force of somebody. And these are things in general people don't think they can change or they can work with. So one was exhaustion, which is what we're talking about. One was addictions and impulsive behaviors. One was hurt feelings and feeling like you're a victim.
Yeah.
And one was demoralization, despondency, quitting.
Oh, okay.
And yeah. We felt in those are areas where Part X tries to fuck you up. It tries to enter your life.
That's the strategy of Part X.
That's its strategy.
That's how they get in.
So these are like the four ways.
Right.
That you get in.
Those are pretty good. That seems solid.
Yeah.
So then so all of a sudden now you have a framework through which people can identify how Part X is getting them.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, here's the secret of that. Part X doesn't want you to know it exists, and it particularly doesn't want you to know that it's acting on you right now.
Yeah, but sometimes when you realize it is, it wants you to believe that that's your true self.
Exactly. You're smart, man. That's exactly 100% right.
Right.
So Part X is an imposter.
Right.
It tries to push you out and take over. And it does it so many times, there's a familiarity to it.
Yeah.
And the familiarity is kind of persuasive. Even though if you look back, it's nuts. But
right, because it sometimes it represents you because the satisfaction that can come when Part X is being satisfied feels like strength, but it isn't.
That's correct.
Right.
That's correct. I'm very impressed so far. Do you have a strong Part X?
I have a very living and breathing relationship with, but I've had some success with it. The mixture between accepting it, compartmentalizing, and trying to stay in those things that you're saying, right? The list that you had, outside of addiction, but insisting that you're a failure or you're feeling embarrassed or demoralized, is that those are natural human experiences.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, instead of fighting against them, you have to process them.
Yes, you have to. Yes, that's exactly right. You have to process them.
All right,
them.
So once you identify these four things, what happens in the book?
Well, the first part of the book is when you, let's say these are four expressions of Part X.
Yeah.
So the first thing you want to do is learn to identify it, not when you're reading a book, not when you're talking to your friends,
right.
But right in the moment.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, that's right. So you once you identify the one that's in you, how's it popping up in your life every second?
Yes.
Right.
And that's specific to each person.
Mm-hmm.
That's
a good day. That's a good moment when you realize that.
Yeah. But it gives the person power. See, the other thing that happens when you realize that is you're like pushing Part X away from you.
Mm.
So at that point, for some people, the first inkling of freedom that they've ever had in their lives.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they see the enemy out there. Did you ever read Pogo? Did you ever read that?
Pogo, the cartoon?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe when I was a kid.
Well, there's a famous thing Pogo said, we have met the enemy.
And he is us.
And he is us.
Yeah.
And that's pretty prescient idea. Anyway, and we tell people, even if you don't know what to do about it, if you can identify it and label it right in the moment.
Yeah.
You're ready on your way to gaining some sort of freedom.
Well, yeah, but then how do you address, negotiating with Part X? You know what I mean? It's sort of like, look, here's where I'm at, me. Like, I'm addicted to these nicotine lozenges, and I have been for years. And, now because, I don't take any other medication, and the world seems to be, crumbling, my anxiety is extremely high, my dread is high, my fear of death is high, my fear of catastrophic death is high. So now I'm ingesting probably more nicotine than I ever have, and I'm drinking a lot of coffee, and I'm fucking nauseous all the time. So now I know that I should get off of the things, and I know that, I've gotten off everything else, but this Part X with this negotiation where it's sort of like, well, what am I going to do without those?
Right. I don't think I can help you.
Wow. Jeez.
No, that was a joke.
You're supposed to tell me, get the book. It's all in the book.
Well, what the book has, besides the four tools and the four expressions of Part X, is it has a philosophy that says the following. This probably will only work for a while. It'll only work temporarily. It'll only work halfway. But if you keep advancing and doing what we're asking you to do, particularly in those blacker moments, we call them holes, mm-hmm. in the hole, you will find that your overall view of who you are and of the world will change. It just takes a tremendous amount of work. Here's the situation.
Incremental.
Yeah, part X will never stop attacking you, never. If you live till 102, it's still going to attack you. But there's something good.
And if your parents are alive, then it has support.
I am not going to touch that one with a 1,000-foot pole, but it's an interesting idea. So, okay, what was I saying?
You were saying that.
Yeah. So the fact that it won't stop attacking you, the good news is if you're willing to work consistently against it using the tools, not only can you overcome some of these symptoms, but you actually, your self-identification changes. And a lot of times you'll discover abilities that you didn't know you had.
Sure.
So it's not just getting rid of the symptoms. There's an expansion. Now, here's what Part X wants. It works on the principle of impossibility. And what that means is it gives you a symptom. Let's say you're afraid of flying, whatever. Mm. It makes sure you can't get over the symptom, right? So there's some crippling thing going on. And it wants to defeat you so badly that you feel this is impossible to change. It may be a little bit what you have with you. What is it you use?
Nicotine lozenge.
Oh, well, right.
It's an addiction. But you're right. But, you know, it will manipulate you and charm you into thinking that, it's got the better way.
Exactly. It's either seducing you or threatening you or both at the same time.
Right.
So, but anyway, that sense of impossibility, I can't change, spreads out all over the place.
Yeah.
And eventually you can't change anything.
Right.
And that's its real goal.
Paralyze you.
Yeah. In other words, if you want to look at it on a spiritual basis, you know about 12-step really well. There's an evolution that human beings can only, in other words, we're all capable of much more than we do.
Yeah.
When we fight off these X attacks, is what we call them, we start to get this sense of possibility. We start to get this sense of, hey, you have more potential than you think you have. Mm-hmm. And that's where the battle is. Part X wants you to think, bullshit, I'm lucky I'm even where I am.
Well, part of that has to be, you have to acknowledge and, maybe slightly celebrate your little victories over this thing.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah, because a lot of times they happen incrementally and they're small things that, it's easy if you have a strong Part X to dismiss any success.
Yes.
Because that's part of the over, that's an over, that's a long, what do you call it? The long game tactic of Part X is to diminish anything you've ever accomplished.
Yeah. Did you study this book before?
No.
You're doing good. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So all of those are go under the heading of impossibility and crippling the person.
Yeah.
So there's a fight. It's like a war. You know, I was, because you're a shrink, you're sitting in an office all day, people think it's a very sedentary kind of passive existence type thing. But for me, it's never been like that at all. For me, it's been a war. And once I identified this X thing working, I felt—
Within you or your patients?
At first, it was my patients. I didn't identify in me till much later.
Right.
Because I thought I was perfect.
Yeah.
Finally, I said, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I'm the one who invented these things, and I'm not taking advantage of them. Am I stupid? then I started to work harder.
Yeah.
The best person I've ever seen, though, using the tools is my partner, he's unbelievably disciplined.
Yeah.
And look, he's probably 60. I don't know what he is, but I can see the change over a 20-year period in him.
These are spiritual ideas, really.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. The point, look, we both of us agreed, whether we're right or wrong, with this idea that there's what we call the gap, which means you can go to a shrink, you can work hard, you can understand where your problems
come. Sure, intellectually.
Yeah, you have all that, which is good, but they have no way to close the gap through action. And it was, now what do we do? Because I haven't found that understanding per se will change somebody. Sometimes it does, but mostly it's not enough.
No, sometimes it enforces their ability to bullshit.
Yes.
Then you can just all of a sudden you become your own therapist. So you sit there, I'm sure you must sit there with clients all the time where they're like, oh, right, I get it. And then next week they come in and it's like, I did the thing again.
Right.
You know, but I understand it.
100%.
And then they keep doing it.
Yeah, the good thing about me is that pisses me off.
Right, yeah.
So I'm not just going to accept that.
You know, I think that the hardest thing for people who have these things is that, you know, once you start to see the patterns of these things hurting your life, which is, I think, what this book will help you do, is that, you know, you start to realize a couple of things like, well, am I going to let it keep happening? And life isn't that long. And like, there's no sort of overarching thing here in the book that's going to say this is going to make you a new person. But for fuck's sake, you know, you got to get a little relief from these patterns so you can get something out of life.
Yes. Yes. And one of the greatest feelings for somebody is being able to do something they thought was impossible, even if it's a small thing.
Yeah.
It changes everything.
No, it does. It's like for me, well, there's a lot of examples. Like, one of the things is you got to be careful with those moments is not to beat yourself up for not doing it sooner.
Yes, that's correct. And that happens all the time.
Because that's a primary tool of the part X.
Yeah, it is.
Is that like, you know, you finally do it and it goes, you fucking asshole, huh? At 50, you do it.
Yeah.
You got nothing.
You are excellent at portraying part X. I'm going to give it to you.
I gave the awesome. You a part X for the movie. I'm the guy.
Yeah, and I'm going to remember that. Yeah, that's correct, 100%.
So what can people like, you know, I think what you're trying to, you know, connect with in the book through these tools is that life is hard. You know, life is, there is suffering, but, you know, and you know, there are challenges always, obviously, like, you know, you have health challenges, other people do, people have, there's no end to it.
Yes.
But, and there's no way you can avoid it.
Correct.
And there's some part that you have that has to embrace these challenges and this suffering, you know, in order to accept it so you can, you know, have a proactive life.
Yeah, look, everybody says, all the shrinks that write these books say, life has to have meaning, and you have to look for it, and you have to find the meaning, which is true. But for me to really feel life is meaningful, I have to close that gap. In other words, I have to use a tool in adversity, counteract the adversity, or even better, turn the adversity into more strength. I have to feel that. If you feel that, you get a sense of meaning. And not only that, the worst things that happen then can give you the most sense of meaning.
Yeah.
If you fight back against them.
Well, yeah, you did a noble thing, and I'm glad you got the new book out. Thank you. And I'm happy to see you. I'm glad you're doing okay.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. And at an appropriate time, I'll come back and check on you again.
Maybe I'll just come to your office.
Okay.
Thanks, Doc.
Just show up. Thank you.
That was me and Dr. Phil Stutz, his new book, Coming Alive, that he wrote with Barry Michaels, out August 22nd. So Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, here's the thing about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and many of you know this about me, is that I'm not a big sports fan. I'm a pretty physical guy, but I'm not a big sports fan, and I don't know a lot about sports. But I did know, of course, that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is one of the greatest basketball players that ever lived, and I felt a little ill-prepared to talk to him, you know, heading into it, but they wanted him to come on the show. He wanted to come on the show. So I was like, yeah, I'll talk to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And fortunately for me, did not want to talk about basketball, really. So that worked out. This is me and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. His book, Coach Wooden and Me, Our 50-Year Friendship on and Off the Court, is now available. The graphic novel of his detective novel, Mycroft Holmes, comes out next month, September 19th. You can pre-order it now. So this is me engaging in conversation with the great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Yeah, it's been I had a bad morning, and maybe you can relate to it. I just found out that the cartridge on my record player is broken.
Oh, no.
And someone just gave me a Wayne Shorter record that I'd never heard before.
Which one?
I don't know. It was just sitting in there, you know, because I'm a Lee Morgan freak right now.
Yeah.
I'm just getting into Lee Morgan. So it's one with Lee Morgan on there playing with Wayne, but not with the Jazz Messengers.
Okay.
And I went to play it, and I guess the woman that cleans my house had...
And now you got to go down.
Now do you have do you still play records?
No.
No more?
No, I went CD because I didn't like the I didn't like the fidelity
of the records.
Of the records, the CD was clean and
yeah.
Play a record sounds like somebody's frying an egg in the background, you know.
Yeah, but you got to get them. Clean records. Get new ones.
I know. But they don't stay new.
Right. You don't buy into the idea that the sound of analog is richer and softer.
It might be. You might have a point there, but I like the CD sound. Cause, you know, you can get it up loud and you can hear it in depth. You know?
Yeah, it's all right there.
And that's important
too. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a little more nuanced to the records. Maybe I'm just part of a fad. I don't know.
Well, it was fun. You know?
Sure.
Somebody explained this to me, and it really bothered me that my kids never had records.
Right.
That they don't know what an LP is.
Right.
Just so much that of the technology that we had when I was a kid it's totally irrelevant and
gone.
It's gone.
And it was something. There was something, you know, tactile. There was something about your connections with even books.
Yeah.
You know, like I got your book right here. You can hold the book. And I guess they still sell books, but most people, they'll listen to books, they'll read them on the Kindle, but I still like to hold the book.
Yeah, it's something about the relationship with it, too.
And you grew up with records. Wasn't your dad a musician?
Yeah, and, you know, I so much of what I learned about jazz, I read on the album covers.
Yeah, stuff, yeah. You know? Nat Hentoff writing about all those dudes.
Yeah.
Like, and the Village Voice, he used to do some of those liner notes.
For the Village Voice, but you know, on all the Blue Note albums, they had extensive notes and stuff.
Yeah,
and there was a real good DJ in New York. His name was Ed Beach.
Yeah,
he always really did a lot of research on every record he played. You know, he could tell you all, you know, the sequence of the solos.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, what it was all about.
Do you got a handle on that stuff? I mean, because I'm just now getting, like, I always sort of listen to jazz, but not as attentively because I was afraid of the rabbit hole because it'd go on forever. Like, you know, there's so much.
But the thing of it is, you just have to go with what you like.
Exactly. You don't have to finish everything.
You don't have to, you know, and if you don't want to spend any time listening to Tommy Dorsey or Kenny G or, you know, anybody you don't want to listen to, you don't have to do it.
No Kenny G. I was up in, do you know who Ben Sidran is? Piano player?
Yes.
He's been on this show, you know, like his...
Really?
His son sort of pestered me and said, you got to talk to my dad. He's a good cat.
He is.
He's a great guy, right? Yeah. So, but the funny thing was that... I went up to Madison to do a comedy show, and Ben reached out to me and said, yeah, I live here. Come hang out. Let's have lunch. So we had lunch. And then we
Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's where he lives. And, you know, I went over to his house, and he's got all those Blue Note records, man. Like, you know, some dude he knew in Japan when they started reissuing him, like, gave him, like, he's got all of the Blue Note records.
All the covers.
Yeah, on the wall. Yeah. And I was looking for this Tina Brooks record with Lee Morgan on it, Minor Move. It's hard to find. And he's going through his stuff, and he's turning me on to hard bop stuff. I didn't realize that there was a subcategory of hard bop. So he's telling me the predecessors and whatnot. And he's got two of those Tina Brooks records. And he goes, take one. And I'm like, hey, this is like the best trip ever.
You can get all of that over in Japan.
Right.
You can go to one store and get all of that.
All the Blue Note stuff.
Yes. And, you know, they got T-shirts and stuff. I remember the Unity T-shirt. And I couldn't get it quick enough.
Man. Yeah,
they,
yeah.
They sold it out. They sold out. One of my favorite albums of all time.
Yeah.
They were incredible. Just the symbiosis of, you know, what they could create.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
When you were a kid, where'd you grow up?
Manhattan.
Right in the city?
Yeah.
So now, was your dad a working musician?
Yeah, but he wasn't the soloist that J.J. Johnson was.
Yeah.
So he couldn't get a job on the front line. And, you know, he's a good section man.
Yeah. What was his instrument?
Trombone.
Oh, yeah.
If he had had his desire, he would have played in Count Basie's band.
So you grew up with that.
Yeah, I did. And, you know, I knew Thelonious. I used to babysit for Ben Reilly.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was Thelonious's drummer.
Yeah.
And, you know, when Ben's wife would come home, I could go down to the Vanguard. They'd usually be playing down there, and I could catch Monk at the Vanguard. I must have seen him perform about 30 times.
Really?
High school and college.
What was he like as a dude? I mean, could you talk to him?
No. You couldn't talk to him. He was somewhere else.
Right.
Most of the time he spent somewhere else. He'd talk to you, like he'd come back and talk to you, and then he'd go off into wherever he was.
But just like check in and then out?
Yeah. But he was a musical genius, no question about it.
No doubt. Was there a point there where you wanted to pursue music over ball?
Yeah, but that ended up being in high school when I had to make a choice.
Yeah.
And you know, I had already made the commitment to basketball, and I was much better at basketball than I was at music. So,
did you play something?
I should have. If I had practiced the piano, I would have had it down, and I could have stayed with it.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't practice. The whole idea of reading music really intimidated me.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I should be able to read it like a printed page, at which I was precocious.
Yeah.
But, it wasn't.
Couldn't do it.
The same thing. And people didn't tell me, oh, no, that just shows you where you place your fingers.
Yeah.
And if someone had explained that to me, I would have, I could have stuck with it longer and figured it out.
Right. So you got overwhelmed.
Yeah. Oh, and I just intimidated.
Right.
And then just like 2002, I decided I'm going to try and take some piano lessons, and I got it. They said, "No, it shows you where you place your fingers,"
and you're like, "Damn, I should have."
And it wasn't that difficult, you know. When I played, what is it, J.S. Bach's very first thing for people beginning piano?
Yeah.
I was able to read it and play it.
Oh, and do you regret not doing it now?
Yeah. Of course, but it's too late.
It's too late. But do you play for enjoyment?
I'm only 60 years too late, you know.
But that hasn't stopped you in the past.
No. And, if you do it for yourself.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Are you doing it?
I might, because sometimes I hear somebody on, and I got to what is that chord? And
Yeah.
Chucho Valdez.
Yeah. And do you incredible. Go work it out? Do you figure it out? At least the one chord?
A couple of chords, and how they relate to each other.
Yeah. It's magic, man.
It is.
It really is magic. So, I've been watching, I guess because in this book, you had a good relationship with your dad?
Yeah.
And your mom, too?
Wasn't close, but, it wasn't bad.
Right.
It just wasn't close. My dad was a very distant kind of guy, and the only thing, two things he liked music and he liked my mom.
Yeah. And what did your mom do?
My mom, she was a seamstress.
Uh-huh. And your dad had a job outside of the music?
My dad was a cop.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My dad was in the police band, so he got to play behind Marilyn Monroe when she sang Happy Birthday to President Kennedy.
Oh, really?
At the Democratic Convention in Madison Square Garden.
No kidding.
So my dad, they figured they get the police band. Everybody's a cop. No, it won't be anybody crazy coming in.
Yeah. They were ready.
Yeah.
Did you go to that thing?
No, I didn't. I have the letter that they sent to my dad thanking him in advance for participating.
Uh-huh.
And they said, just bring this letter with you to such and such a gate, such and such an entry at Madison Square Garden.
And that's how he got in?
That's how he got in. And that was the highlight of his musical career.
Because this new book, which it's a few months old though, is about you and Coach Wooden, and that's a long relationship that seems sort of like a fatherly relationship.
Yeah, it was. It just started out. He was the coach and I was the player, and
right.
We started to become friends, and then we became close friends, and then it just kept morphing. And
but he was with you through all your changes, right? And supportive.
More or less, it became like we were family.
Yeah. And those conversations, in terms of when you became more politically active and you chose to, change, your religious affiliation and all this stuff, was he a guy that would sit with you and question your motives?
No.
And no.
But sometimes, he would want to draw you out and ask you, what motivated you? And, he wanted to know about, how much thought you'd given it.
Yeah.
And how much research you'd devoted, and just how much into it were you, or was this just a lark?
And what were some of the things that he part of his process in terms of how they sort of guided you throughout your life? You know, like what were the things that you learned either, you know, on the court or off the court or just as a human being that gave you strength from this guy?
Well, I think that he just gave us confidence that we were prepared.
Uh-huh.
You know, and because he prepared us. And
yeah.
He said, you know, if you follow these things I'm showing you, you're going to be able to, you'll enjoy the way that you play the game.
And you were able to apply that to life?
Yeah. It's amazing, you know, just what we learned about how to support the people that we care about.
Right. And that goes through life. See, yeah. it's a weird thing for me because I was not brought up with sports. You know, I'm not a huge sports guy. And you know, obviously I know who you are and I respect you and the writing and everything, but I can't sit here and do stats with you. Or
why would we want to do that anyway?
We wouldn't want to do it anyway. But there are dudes that I imagine you have to deal with that all your life.
Oh, yeah. And people are like, geez, you know, Larry Bird didn't. Yeah, come on, man.
But through it all, I mean, being that, you know, you are one of the greatest players that ever lived, that, you know, was it from the beginning, knowing that you could do it and you were good at it, and obviously that was undeniable at a very early age, was there something going from the inside that's sort of like, I want to do something else?
Yeah, there was.
Yeah.
But I liked the game.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was neat. You know, I enjoyed playing it.
Yeah.
And can make some bucks. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And I had some skill that translated into a professional career. And I was really thankful that I had the opportunity.
My producer, who knows a little more about sports than me, said that you were always judged for your attitude. And you know, that kind of hung over you. Like I just looked at this interaction you had, you know, with Donald Trump, you know, the letter he sent you.
Right.
Which is something he did to anybody that pissed him off, right?
Right.
But he went out of his way just to diminish you and try to, you know, bully you in your soft spot.
Right, but, you know, I've dealt with bullies.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I'd love to meet him out back. That won't happen. So,
Not anymore. You might have been, a few years ago, you might have been able to pull it off.
No. He doesn't impress me as someone with a lot of guts.
I was reading, I was watching a documentary on Vietnam, the new Ken Burns documentary. You know, that's a 10-part documentary about that period. And you lived through all of that.
I did. I graduated from high school in 1965, just when it was ramping up, you know, the war.
And so you knew a lot of guys that went.
Yeah, I had guys, some of my friends went over there and didn't come back.
Were you eligible for the draft, obviously? Or
I was eligible in that I was old enough, but at 6 foot, 8 being the top height, you know, and I was 7 feet tall.
Wasn't going to happen.
And I just had to go by my board, and they said, yeah, you're too tall. And that was it.
Yeah. So at what point did you, like, you know, find yourself? Because the one thing that I didn't remember, because I'm 53, so I was young. But, you know, the country is polarized now. But, like, I didn't really understand the intensity or the scope of the polarization in the late 60s, both around civil rights and the war. And it seems that, you know, what we're living in now, the country we're living in, was really invented in relation to that war. That those fights are the same fights that are going on now.
Yeah, the same conflicts with regard to, you know, what is the future of America?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when did you, what was the thing that kind of like, you know, blew your mind open about, you know, becoming engaged and becoming, that drove you to become engaged, to become active, to become awake and fighting?
I just felt that, you know, Black Americans had to get to a point where we had first class citizenship.
Yeah.
Second class citizenship sucks, man. And just having to always defer because people don't think you're worthy.
Yeah.
It's horrible. It just defeats you at every turn, and you can't be your best.
Yeah.
And you know, that's one of the great things about America. We all get a chance to do our thing and give our best impression of what our life should be about.
Yeah. And you felt that, and obviously it's true. To a large degree, that was not available in the same way for Black Americans as it was for others.
No, it wasn't. We had to defer to people who felt that we weren't worthy of being successful. And, you know, we had to put an end to that.
When you converted to Islam, what was it that drove that decision?
I was raised Roman Catholic, you know, and monotheism seemed to make sense to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Roman Catholics' support of the slave trade really, that turned me off.
Yeah.
So I wanted to figure out, you know, what monotheistic religion I could support that didn't have that type of history.
But you had no, you always believed in God.
Yeah, I always believed in a supreme being. It seemed to make sense to me.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was it. And now was that why that particular religion? Was it popular at the time as a statement, or was it, you know, you could have become a Jew?
Absolutely. No, you know, being of African descent,
yeah.
The monotheistic religion that is most popular in Africa is Islam.
Yeah.
And Islam has a great history in terms of what it's contributed to world culture, you know, mathematics and the physical sciences.
Sure.
Extraordinary contributions. What the Muslims did in starting medicine, the Renaissance absolutely started because Europeans came into contact with the scholarship of the Muslim world.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't want to acknowledge it.
Right. But when you protested the Olympics in 68 and boycotted the Olympics, what happened when you did that?
Well, a lot of people thought that I was supposed to just be content to have access to playing in the NBA.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was supposed to make my money and keep my head down and not complain about anything.
So they expected that from Ali too, right?
They expected that from all black people.
Yeah. So when you did that, was the hostility, did it show up at the games and everything?
No, you know, people were, you know, oftentimes pretty subtle with it. You know,
yeah.
they didn't want to be too obvious with it because they had seen some of the negative aspects of white supremacy, and there's no way people could defend that.
Right, until now.
Yeah.
That's
seems to have made, you know, a return.
Yeah, which is heartbreaking, awful.
Yeah, but it's what we got to deal with.
Yeah. Did you, when what is happening now happened, did you, was your initial response was like, well, now we can see them in the light because they've got a voice, but they were always there.
Yeah, they were always there, and it was people seem to have forgotten that because just so much of the past, I think certainly the Clinton administration and Obama's administration, they saw minorities making a lot of headway. And even though I've been fortunate enough to do well,
yeah,
you still see what's happening, and too many people can't find their way out of the things that keep pulling them backwards.
Yeah, and it becomes harder to when the ways that there are get shut off.
Yeah, and, you know, there's no way out. There's no way to, you know, get your little piece of sunshine.
Right. Yeah. Did you have fun in the 70s?
Yeah, I did. I had fun, but it was tough. A lot of during that time, everybody just seemed to want to question everything. You know, are they getting too much?
Oh yeah,
yeah. You know, just because as the barriers fell down for black participation in American society, it was questioned.
Yeah,
yeah.
Now, when you like, I know that you've done a lot of different sort of. I kind of have a vague memory of you in some sort of martial arts attire. Was that something? Because you study with Bruce Lee. Is that
yeah,
true?
I trained with Bruce. Yeah,
and like that guy, like I can't like he died way too young. But what was he like? So now you babysat. You knew Monk and you knew Bruce Lee. These guys are like, you know, magicians. They're mystics.
Absolutely, you know, and Bruce was great because he felt that you know, the martial arts should be practiced and learned by everybody. He wasn't going to teach just Chinese.
Right.
You know,
he kind of opened it up.
He said, I learn from everybody. I teach everybody. That was his attitude. He was awesome in that sense, because the martial arts are so tradition bound. And, you know, if you study like a Korean system of martial arts, you're supposed to think that any other system sucks.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't learn from them. And he was eclectic in the things that he chose to use. And he said, you got to use what works for you. That has to deal with your physique and your level of athletic ability.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, just what you can learn. And you got to make it pragmatic for yourself.
Were you in one of his movies?
Yeah, I was in The Game of Death.
I can't, like, it's wild that these little flashes of you come back in my mind in movies and on TV shows. So, like, was he like a philosophical guy, or was he just a physical, like, kind of?
He was a philosophical guy. He got his degree from the University of Washington in philosophy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And did you glean anything from? What was his basic?
He was kind of like a modern day Taoist priest. You know? Just the pragmatic road to success and harmony. You know, that's more or less what he was about.
That was his trip?
Yeah.
And do you still practice any disciplines?
Some yoga.
Yeah?
The yoga really helps. And, you know, I train a little bit and I jump some rope and, you know, try to stay in shape and not become a fat person.
Do you think that could happen to you?
No, not at this point.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah, yeah. When did you start the writing?
I started writing really in grade school. You know, I used to represent my school in essay contests. The nuns thought that I was that accomplished.
It was always something you wanted to do?
Yeah, I always enjoyed reading.
Yeah.
And then I always had ideas about stories. And I was an English major at UCLA.
Who were the authors that moved you first?
Robert Louis Stevenson.
Sure.
Rudyard Kipling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those guys.
Big stories.
Yeah.
Stories of...
The classic stories.
Sure, yeah.
Kidnapped, you know.
Sure, yeah.
Treasure Island.
Yeah. There's struggle, there's swashbuckling, there's, right. You know... There's
mystery.
Everything.
Yeah.
And, like, there was a time there where you were sort of hanging out with some of the because it seemed like in the 70s, the writers were, like, superstars. Like, they were present in the cultural landscape. They'd show up at talk shows, you know, like in Mailer and Talese and all those cats.
Oh, yeah.
There was a sort of, like, urbane intelligentsia that kind of had a hold on culture a little bit.
Yeah, and their voices were important.
Right.
You know? And especially when it started with the whole feminist movement.
Yeah, yeah.
Women started to change things for the better.
And were you hanging out with those cats at all, with the writers and dudes?
Well, you know, I got to meet and know Gay Talese.
Yeah, yeah.
And nice guy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He wrote some pretty provocative books.
The one I liked the best, Fame and Obscurity.
Yeah. Why'd you like that one?
Just the different portraits of people, you know, that, you know, Frank Sinatra has a cold. He wrote about the heavyweight champion Floyd Patterson, who used to go around with disguises because he didn't want people to recognize him.
Yeah.
Stuff like he wrote about the building of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge.
Yeah.
You know what it was all about. Just different stuff that, like, really interested me. That
How did it change your ideas about how your fame was playing out? I mean, you can't really...
I don't think it did that, but it just made me aware of things in the world that, you know, I had no idea of. You know?
Right, right. There's little nooks and crannies where you're like, holy shit.
Yeah, that's some pretty interesting stuff. Yeah.
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 And is that what sort of sparked you to become more of a cultural commentator and to explore the things that you explored?
And just, you know, the things that make me go, you know, holy, wow, what's that all about?
Right. And so you were able to sort of like do that stuff. I mean, like to do like a book like Profiles in Courage, and then to do the book about the Tank Brigade. I mean, these are historical elements that are, you know, that a lot of people don't know about, but were fascinating to you.
To me, and especially the one about the Tank Battalion, the 761st Tank Battalion. One of the guys in there, Leonard Smith, he received the Bronze Star, just an incredible combat record. But, you know, I remember when I was a little kid, World War II, you know, they were always acknowledging those guys, their tremendous sacrifice. And
the guys.
The guys. And
right.
And the women. And, you know, Tom Brokaw does The Greatest Generation to acknowledge them.
Yeah.
And here you have a group of them, black Americans, who supported the war and used the war as a means to fight Hitler and Jim Crow.
Yeah.
I went to see the screening of a documentary on the unit.
Yeah.
And when I went, this is in 1992, and I go there, and there's Leonard Smith, and I remember him from when, the last time I'd seen him, I'd been in high school, all right? And I'm 42 years old now.
Yeah.
And I see Smitty. I'm like, Smitty, what are you doing here? And I find out he was in the 761st Tank Battalion. And then I watched the documentary and find out that he fought in the Battle of the Bulge and then was with Patton, the first Allied units into Germany proper.
Wow.
They crossed the Rhine River first.
Yeah.
And they cleaned out the Siegfried Line.
Yeah.
Smitty was given a Bronze Star. I had no idea.
How did you know him from when you were younger?
He was a police officer with my father.
Oh, my God.
So I'd known Smitty since I was 7 or 8 years old, and he was just this guy that was kind of crazy cop that hung out with my dad. He and my dad would go hear the big bands, you know, when they came to New York.
Yeah.
You know, all the bands that they liked when they were younger. So, you know, when Count Basie or Lionel Hampton came to New York, my dad and Smitty would go down and hear them.
But no talk of World War II.
No talk of war. I had no idea of what he had done, and I find out he won the Bronze Star. And
Your old man know, you think? He must have,
no,
right?
No, my dad didn't know.
So do you think it was one of those things where
those guys didn't talk about it.
Right.
They came home and just, you know, they were just glad to get home.
And got to work.
And got to work and, you know, started doing things,
Isn't that something?
It's amazing.
So now, like, when you see him again at that thing, this whole other world opens up to you.
Right.
And you decide, like, why doesn't everybody know about this?
Yeah, so I had to do something, and I wrote my book, Brothers in Arms, so that their story would be told accurately, because there were a few things in the documentary that they got confused.
Oh,
They conflated some of the things.
Yeah, and how many of those guys were alive at the time were you able to talk to?
Oh, there were about 20 or 30 of them. This is like, you know, in right after 2000.
Yeah.
I published a book in 2004.
Yeah.
And
so there are a few of them still alive?
Yeah, very few now. They've
right.
Since then, they've all passed on. Smitty died the year after I published the book. He died in 2005. So did my father.
Oh, right.
And so, you know, a whole lot of guys in the unit have died and passed on.
But he was able to see the book.
Yeah, they were. And they really thanked me. They gave me they acknowledged me for telling the story accurately.
Uh-huh.
That's all they wanted. You know, they just wanted to have it told accurately. And
you got it.
Yeah, I got it right. Clinton gave one of the guys in the unit the Congressional Medal of Honor posthumously in 1998 or 99. That was given to Reuben Rivers of Oklahoma.
Yeah.
He was given a posthumous Congressional Medal of Honor.
Is your book being read in schools now? I mean, does it give
you... No, but it was for sale on all the PXs, and a lot of military people got to read it.
Oh, did they?
A lot of them have come and thanked me. You know, said, "Hey, I really enjoyed that. It really helped me understand a lot about what the black experience in World War II was all about." You know, because you know, black Americans had to fight for the right to fight.
Wow.
You know, and they finally did it. And then after the war was over, Truman integrated the armed forces and said that you know. A segregated army is an inefficient army, and we're not going to do that anymore.
Awesome. Well, that's one of the things I noticed, you know, that they kind of talk about in the Vietnam documentary is that he spent a lot of time with it because it's Ken Burns, you know, so you know, he does a pretty good job. And, you know, he talked about how, you know, the fragmentation and the racial tension of the states, you know, once you got, you know, into the shit, that, you know, that stuff kind of, that goes away.
Right.
And, you know, it's like everybody's just a person here.
Right.
And we got to think.
We all want to live and survive and get right. back, you know, to America.
So it seems like also with the other book, the On the Shoulders of Giants, that part of your mission in life is to sort of, you know, show, you know, black history for what it really is.
Yeah, and show all of America, that black Americans have contributed so much to what makes America great.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's not like we're just here and, you know, occupying space. You know, we've managed to make America a better place.
And what did you find, what did you learn about that period, the Harlem Renaissance, they call it?
Oh, just the fact that so many things that affected American culture in the 20th century started with the Harlem Renaissance, you know, starting with jazz music, but so many other things.
Dance. And the arts in general, and I guess literature as well.
Absolutely.
Cultural commentary,
and the fact that, you know, also integrating sports and taking that on a totally different plane and adding to its luster.
Yeah. Did you see that documentary? I'm Not Your Negro.
That was extraordinary.
I talked to that guy, Raoul Peck.
Yeah, I've met him also.
What a guy, huh?
He's incredible.
Oh God.
But you know, for me, it just I needed to see that because it was like right after the election, and you know, I was down.
Yeah.
I went and saw that, and I was like, wow. Because, you know, when I was in the eighth grade is when I first read James Baldwin and became aware of him. And he helped me understand things that my parents couldn't explain to me. You know, my parents couldn't articulate what was happening in America and why things were so bad for black Americans. They couldn't articulate it. We could see it. We could see that we were, you know, oppressed. But the words to express that, you know, my parents weren't too good at that.
Yeah.
And James Baldwin was able to, like, just define it and get people to understand what it was about and how absolutely necessary it was to see that it came to an end.
Yeah, and what an amazing thinker. The levels of intellectual, you know, acumen was, like, mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I watched that documentary, and I was like, I had to watch it two or three times.
Right.
You know, just to sort of even begin to take on the intellectual depth of that guy.
Yeah, to understand the context of everything. Yeah.
It's mind-blowing, man. And when I had Peck in here, the thing that, like, struck me about that conversation was that, you know, he comes from Haiti. So, you know, fighting the fight is something that it's not taken for granted in any way. Nothing is ever accepted. You're born into it, and you got to push back.
And to understand the commitment, that's really the thing. I've seen John Lewis speak.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not bitter about anything. And, he had a concussion. They could have killed him, you know, when he crossed the bridge that day. And he said, look, you know, I could have gotten killed, but if you do not put your life on the line, you are not committed to nonviolence.
Right.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And, you know, he showed exactly how much that took. You know, he said he had his Bible in one pocket and an apple or something.
Yeah.
In case he got hungry, and he just saw what was coming and battened down, but did not step backwards.
Yeah.
That kind of courage, man. Wow.
It's wild, right?
Yeah.
And it's not, it doesn't come easy, and most people would rather not deal with it.
Right. It's so much easier, not, you know, to let someone else
until no one else is going.
Right.
And, right.
Unless you understand that, you can't say that you're committed. And he made that very clear. Wow.
When this happened, when this election happened, you know, after 8 years of Obama, and, you know, however you feel about him as a president, he was a good president. You know, every president has his shortcomings and does things you don't like. But, you know, it is a cultural beacon for the country. When this happened, I mean, what was your first gut reaction?
My first gut reaction to
Trump's election.
I couldn't understand how he... where he found the votes.
Yeah.
You know, because I thought that most Americans were appalled at who he was.
Yeah.
But they weren't. I mean, there were some Americans that were waiting for someone like that to step forward.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. Yeah, you know, it's like they resent the fact that... it seems to me that some people resent the fact that people of color are being given an equal chance to be successful. That to me can be the only, you know, they resent seeing people of color doing well, and they think that they're supposed to do well before people of color. Maybe that's it.
But didn't you write a bit about how, like, the idea of non-white people outnumbering white people became sort of threatening?
It's become threatening, or I think sometimes it has to do with resentment that those people might have political power, and we have to do something about it. I think that's why we're getting all this voter suppression efforts,
right,
by Republicans.
Right.
They don't like the fact that the color of the people that are, you know, accruing more power, it bothers them that they're not white.
And what so, like, after all this, like, you know, when we talk about progress and when you talk about, you know, what you put your, you know, what you did, the actions you took, and people like Lewis and people, you know, that have been fighting this fight forever, when the sort of pushback and the sort of one step forward, two step back feeling of it, you know, what...
I don't get it. I don't have anything against people in Appalachia doing well.
Yeah.
You know, if something happens where they get a leg up and start to do well, I'm happy for them. That's great.
Yeah.
Why can't they feel that way about other segments of our society, about Hispanics or Black Americans or Native Americans doing better and
yeah, everybody succeeding,
being successful? You know, I think we all benefit from that.
Yeah, I just think that, like, it strikes me recently is that, and it was sort of a big epiphany, oddly, was that it just seems that it outside of just racism, that they have a very different idea of what America's supposed to be, of right, what democracy is supposed to be, that the idea of equality and diversity is not what it's supposed to be in their mind. And yet they still think they're being patriotic.
Yeah, and they want to deny success to certain segments of society because they don't have more success. I don't get that. That it makes no sense.
It's resentment. It's spite. It's jealousy. It's envy. It's a class issue, a lot of it, right? Yeah, there's race, but there's also, like, poor people on either side have a difficult time.
Right, and a lot of times people don't want to admit that.
They don't want to admit it at all here.
Yeah,
you know,
it's ridiculous.
Yeah. So, what was it like when you got given the opportunity to be an ambassador for two administrations? What was that responsibility to you?
I thought it was a great privilege, and it reminded me of, you know, one of my heroes who had a chance to do the same thing, Louis Armstrong. You know?
Yeah. And what was the activities? What was the job, in a way?
Just to explain what democracy is all about, I went to Brazil. And, you know, the people in Brazil were, like, shocked that Obama got elected president. They didn't think that democracy worked like that.
Oh, really?
So, you know, to see that happen and a Black American got elected, it changed their ideas about democracy and their own potential.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was.
It's interesting, too, now that, like, you know, given, you know, the other side of that, that this guy that we have now was elected, is also having, you know, repercussive ripples globally, but it's the opposite. It's like, well, if that shit can happen in America, we better, you know, make sure it doesn't happen here.
Right, because, you know, you get the wrong person at the wheel. That's kind of reminds me of some lyrics from, are you familiar with Mose Allison?
Yeah.
Somebody's always playing with dynamite, so I don't worry about a thing because I know nothing's going to come out right.
That's a good one. So where else did you travel when you were doing that?
That was it.
And then what did Obama have you do?
Oh, nothing.
Nothing?
I didn't do it. I'm on the Coin Commission.
Which is?
People, we suggest coin themes for our coinage.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you get that gig?
I'm a coin collector and
you are?
Yeah.
Like still?
Yeah.
What's the fascination?
I read Ron Chernow's book on Hamilton and just saw what he did in putting together our fiscal policy and our monetary policy and realized maybe I should have gold coins, American gold coins, because they represent something. And I was able to ride up. Gold went from $400 an ounce up to $1,200 an ounce. I even made some money on it.
Oh, yeah? Got some gold?
Yeah.
It went down. Now it's up again, huh?
It's up and down. You know.
But like, I saw a documentary once on how they secure currency, and it blew my mind. Like, it was all about, like, basically it starts with the recipe for the paper of American currency and how, you know, at that level, how do we secure that? It's a specific recipe. It's pulp, and some of it comes from cotton, and they have the little blue and red strands in there, and then you got to do the watermark thing. I was just fascinated with the efforts that went into guaranteeing that the currency stands for something.
Yeah, and so it can't be counterfeited.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It was just like the thought process that went into it kind of blew my mind.
Yeah.
So what are some of your ideas for coinage?
They wanted to, we do the coins and metals that the United States produces.
What, ingots?
No, not ingots, but they have...
metals, you mean that are given to people.
That are given to people and that citizens can buy. You can buy metals.
Yeah. Silver and...
Silver and gold medals with different themes on them.
Well, did any of your ideas get onto the medals?
No, but, you know, it's interesting to learn the process, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do you know, when did you stop showing up on TV shows and stuff? Like, as an actor, when did that kind of...
Oh, geez. While I was playing, I was still, it was still in the 80s, and they don't have roles for guys that are 7 feet tall, you know?
you were funny in Airplane. Come on.
Yeah, I was playing myself. You have to play yourself. So now that I write and can be behind the camera and at my pad writing stories, it's a lot better that way. I'm enjoying writing and...
How those detective books do? How they're written for, what are they, for teenagers primarily?
Or? No. The book I wrote is about Sherlock Holmes' older brother, Mycroft. Is basically his backstory.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting because that's a different angle because some people have approached that before, you know, the side stories of Holmes. Yeah. And yours is sort of a new one.
Yeah. The way it came together was if you read Arthur Conan Doyle, he only mentions Sherlock's brother a couple of times, like right. 6 or 7 times.
In passing?
Yeah, but it says about him, he was really something in the British government, and at certain moments, he was the British government.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's a powerful somebody in the British government, and he helped Sherlock at various times because of his position.
Right, right.
But that's all it. You know about him.
So you got to build the whole...
I built the whole backstory, you know...
Yeah.
And that was the first book, and the second book comes out this fall.
And how are they received? Good?
The first one was received well. I was shocked. The character of Sherlock Holmes was based on a doctor that Arthur Conan Doyle knew. Conan Doyle was an ophthalmologist.
Uh-huh.
He knew another doctor named Joseph Bell,
mm-hmm.
who was able, if he looked at you, he could just tell from your clothing and, you know, just what he could observe about you. A lot about you.
Yeah.
Just noticing the soot on your shoes or certain.
Yeah. Oh, he's that guy. He could read you.
He could read you like that.
Yeah.
And it was a doctor that Arthur Conan Doyle knew.
Yeah.
And that's.
That was the root of it.
That was the root for Sherlock.
Yeah.
That Sherlock could just put all these things together and know
quickly.
So much about you.
Yeah.
Immediately. And it had to do with his knowledge of chemistry and all kinds of.
Yeah.
Arcane thing.
Yeah.
But it's fun for me. I enjoy it. I've enjoyed all of the stuff I've read by John le Carré and
you like that stuff, huh?
Walter Mosley.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Raymond Chandler and all those guys.
How long do you write every day?
Not every day. Sometimes I have other assignments. I have to do articles or
I read a piece you wrote on girls. That was good. That was tight.
Yeah. And, yeah. Had a few things that I liked about girls, a few things that I was critical about. But Miss Dunham has done a great job with that.
Yeah. And how's your health?
My health is pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm in pretty good shape.
Yeah. Now, I remember when you had a quadruple bypass?
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Oof.
Scary.
I can't imagine, man.
I just found out that my heart arteries were a five-star hotel for plaque.
Yeah. You just found out.
I found out 2 years ago, and I had no idea. The Widowmaker, the one they call the Widowmaker, that was 100% blocked.
Oh, my God.
I had blockages 180%, 80%, and 60%.
But had you been, did you have high cholesterol?
No.
You didn't?
No high cholesterol. There's nothing wrong with my heart.
So what did the doc say? How's that happen?
Some people's arteries are just the perfect place
for the plaque.
For the plaque to collect.
Because I went and got one of those calcium scans just recently just because someone said I could just go do it. And
yeah,
I got,
you should.
I got a little in there. A little in there. Yeah.
And
I got
it won't kill you if the right things are...
Are done.
Are done, yeah.
So I noticed when Letterman had his, did you find, did it change your emotionally? Did it change you? Did you wake up, feel more sensitive or more, like life was more fragile?
You feel more vulnerable.
Right.
You get depressed at times just realizing that the things that can go wrong will go wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
You never think that that's going to happen to you.
Oh, yeah. And does it...
I have a son. One of my sons is a physician. He said, Dad, don't worry about it. You're lean, you exercise, you eat right.
Before that thing.
Before, and I went in and they said, you got all these blockages. And my son, the doctor, thought maybe I might need a stent or something.
Yeah.
But telling.
Yeah, they had to do the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, what is your day? How are you approaching the day to day fight of this? That what's coming at you now as an American Muslim man, as a black man, like on a day to day basis? How much shit are you getting?
It's not too bad now because. Muslims in America are waking up to the fact that they have to engage
mm-hmm.
and they have to let people know what they're about. There's nothing wrong with Islam. It's some of the people who are interpreting it in bizarre and extreme ways that are the problem. And, that has happened. We have that example here in our country, a group called the Ku Klux Klan that claimed to be the Christian Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And, they're terrorists.
Yeah.
And, they terrorize blacks and Jews and other minorities. So, we have to understand what things actually are and deal with them for what they are. If we can do that, we won't get lost in, arguing about things. We got to protect everybody and make the Constitution a real living document that protects and enables all Americans to succeed.
On a day-to-day basis, what's your process? What do you do? You exercise? You write a little bit? You think about things?
Well, if I have a writing assignment, I try to deal with that. But, I just try to take care of myself and work out a little bit in the morning.
Yeah.
I have a granddaughter now. She's incredible.
Oh, that's great. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
How old?
She's 2.5.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
That must bring a lot of love and joy.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
It helps me, keeps things in balance.
Do you go out and speak at all? Do you go to schools or anything?
Not at schools, but, I work for a pharmaceutical company sometimes and talk to patients that have leukemia. I'm a leukemia survivor, and I talk to them about...
you fought some fights, huh?
Yeah, had to.
Yeah, how'd you get the leukemia into check?
Fortunately... I have the type that I have chronic myeloid leukemia, and yeah. I can treat it.
Mm-hmm. And so you go offer some support and tell people about their options.
And just let them know that they're not alone and they can beat it.
And do you feel hope? Kareem.
Absolutely. You know, I know there's hope because, you know, remember when we talked earlier about James Baldwin and I'm Not, and it made just made me remember how bad things were, and they were a lot worse than they are now.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just have to rewrite the ship and get it back to where it needs to be.
All right. Well, thanks for talking to me, man.
It was wonderful.
I'm glad you came.
It was nice talking with you.
Okay, that's it. That's it. That was good. He's intense. Very tall. He's a very tall man. Yeah. He almost hit his head on the ceiling of the garage. So I will talk to you Thursday. I will play guitar through, I think, a new... I've just been like, as if you've been keeping up with this portion, I've been just plugging in these pedals. I don't know what they do. This is an Earthquaker transmitter. But it's kind of haunting. Haunting sound. Boomer lives!